A great disappointment, listeners. He is not encased in plaster after all. I promise them plaster.
Oh, no.
Anthony, and here you are wearing a suit, for God's sake.
No, I'm not wearing a suit. I'm wearing a totally unmatching jacket and trousers. But it's very nice to be here, Philip, whatever I'm wearing.
Okay, this bloke is best known for his body, whether it's plastered or not. Before your mind wanders to male models or athletes or Adonis, just wait. Anthony Gormley makes an interesting point. He says the human body isn't just the flesh and blood of its structure, but a place wherein we live and learn. As you must know, he's a prolific artist who isn't afraid to put his body on the line for his art. For the last few decades, he's been casting moulds for statues from his own body. I understand he swathes himself in what we call glad wrap. More about that later. And his work pops up across the planet, from the centre of London to New York City, China, and even, and this is the main focus of our little chat tonight, the desert of Western Australia. In fact, Australia seems to be a bit of a favourite destination for Anthony. He's been here several times since the 80s, this time to present his latest exhibition at the Anna Schwartz Gallery in Sydney. And having prized himself, no, he's sawn out of the plaster, he doesn't prize himself free, he's been kind enough to come in and join me in the studio. Do you ever get claustrophobic and when you are being swathed in plaster, mummified in effect?
Well, by now, no, because I, you know, it's really wonderful. When I'm in there, nobody can get at me. And it's really great. I don't have to do anything. It's the only time when, you know, I'm not expected to kind of answer the telephone. Or
can I pop around and be swathed too?
Well, you could.
You need more plaster for me.
We did do 300 citizens of Newcastle and Gateshead to make Domain Field.
300?
Yeah, 300. Three of the ladies did faint. None of them gave up. One of them fainted twice, and every time the assistants that were doing the plastering said, now, Margaret, do you really want to go on? And she said, yes, of course I do. We had a special ice-cold plant spray that tended to revive people when they fainted. But anyway,
MI5 were kind enough to send us your dossier, so I have your background here.
Oh, really?
And I was astonished.
That's a bit worrying.
I was astonished to learn that the youngest of seven, German mother, Irish father, growing up in North London.
Yeah.
Art a large part of family life? Or not
yeah,
at
not,
all?
Yeah, not terribly. I mean, you know, my father seemed to be, you know, he liked going to the National Gallery, and he took me to the British Museum, and I think it was seeing those huge, great winged bulls from Assyria.
Yeah.
The Palace of Sardon. Yeah, I mean, it makes you shiver even to speak those words, you know, Nebuchadnezzar.
He just gave a shiver. I actually saw him shiver when he spoke them.
Anyway, my dad was a sort of captain of industry, and
I don't think captain is really the sufficient title. He was more a general, wasn't he, of industry?
Oh, well, I don't know. Anyway, yeah,
it was
no,
pretty big
he
time.
It was a serious job that he did, and certainly when I was growing up, he was always coming back from Malaysia or Australia. Indeed, he was here, or India, where he was setting up factories to produce penicillin and other pharmaceuticals. And I think he was an extraordinary man, really, because he did a lot in a short space of time.
A strict Roman Catholic?
Yeah, very.
And you were brought up in the faith?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you a lapsed Catholic or still a strict
Catholic? No, I am a non-believer. I'm very grateful for the education that it gave me, but I also feel that in some way that underpinning of the stick and the carrot of heaven and hell as a kind of moral background for the stringent domestic order that my
mother... you've escaped the plaster of dogma, haven't you, really?
Yeah, I think it was going to India. I went first when I was 18, and I was absolutely fascinated. My dad used to get sent every Christmas a crate of Alfonso mangoes from somewhere down south, and somehow the smell of those, as well as the taste, made India a kind of promised land for me. And when I finally got there, aged 18, I knew that it had something that I needed. So after I finished at university, that's where I went. And
having studied archaeology, anthropology, art history at Trinity at Cambridge, and you then attended Central Martins College of Art, Design and Goldsmithering.
Goldsmiths. Goldsmiths. Goldsmiths it has become the sort of cathedral of conceptualism, was the birthplace of people like Damien Hirst, was an incredible school.
Were you ever tempted by formaldehyde instead of plaster?
Never liked formaldehyde. No,
it stinks, doesn't it?
Really? Never liked formaldehyde. I don't think it does you any good at all. But there are interesting enough. Damien is also, an ex-Catholic, and I think that having, in a sense, this very very rich mythology and its attached magical thinking, I think, it gives you some structure to really work against.
One night on the program, I had three extraordinary women, dissident women on the program, one an ex-Australian premier, one an African-American, the only member of the Senate or Congress who voted against the war on terror, and the third was someone who spat the dummy and walked away from Tony Blair over Iraq.
Good for him.
And I was trying to work out what these three women had in common, and then suddenly it was revealed they were all lapsed Catholics. Mm. In other words, they brought to their life the overarching ethical and belief systems, but they were also... became strongly hostile to dogma.
Yeah, well, I think I'm in a very similar situation. I think if you have had it's interesting that you call it overarching. I think if you've had a philosophical and, in a way, spiritual system that attempts to explain everything, even if it is a mystery and therefore unexplainable, and give it some sense of purpose, I think that there is, once you leave it, there is a very strong impetus to try and create something similar for yourself. And my wife said to me the other day, I had to give a lecture, or I don't know what it was a talk at the Art Gallery in New South Wales, and she said, I think that was a little bit too priestly. And I sympathise with that. It's very strange, the earnestness with which I am aware I kind of... begin to put my point across, which becomes, I think it's just simply from having heard so much from the pulpit as a child.
I'm looking at a very compelling image, a very isolated figure that could result from a close encounter of the third kind, or it could be, in fact, a variation on an ancient Cycladic figure. And it's standing with arms... not stretched out, but widely apart, in the middle of a desert. What am I looking at?
You're looking at a Wanga or Wangatha woman who has had two-thirds of her body mass removed in order to reveal something that I call an insider. It's an abstracted... an abstracted body form that is made from the minerals that have been derived from the landscape in which she stands. She is one of 51 sculptures that stand at the west end of Lake Ballard, looking in all directions on a salt plain that is sometimes covered in water and sometimes completely crystalline. And It's a meditation that I invite people to share by walking through this relational field on the relationship between identity and place. This was a work that I made a long time ago, I think 2003, for the Perth International Arts Festival. And I'm going to go and see it later on this week with my wife, who's never seen it.
So it's one of a collection of what, 50?
51.
51.
51. And they are...
And they stand they over, what, 10 square kilometres?
10 square kilometres. And you see at the back of this image, there's an island, or anyway, a raised mound. The whole installation can be seen from the top of a 60 meter high mound that's very close to the edge of Lake Ballard.
Figures on white salt.
That's right. They're made of basically of ferrous, basically something very close to stainless steel, but they're oxidized and carbonized. But within that stainless steel is molybdenum, iridium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, copper. And what I hope is that this concentrated human image that in some way reasserts the coexistence of human consciousness and landscape in their very extreme form.
I've got to tell you, it works for me. This concentrated human being concentrates the mind wonderfully. And it astonishes me that each of these 51 images derives from the physicality of a real human being, all of whom had to be, persuaded, lured, seduced, cajoled into cooperating.
There was a terrible day. We had brought this man, Ralph, from Los Angeles with his cyberware body scanner that he set up in the old town hall in Menzies. And we had made it known. I'd been around the entire community, both white and indigenous, telling them about that I wanted to make a work that celebrated, in a way, the community closest to this extraordinary geological site. And we stood there, waited for 3 hours. I said, come after sundown, come around 6 o'clock, and nobody came. And I just felt this whole thing is going to be a disaster.
Yes.
But anyway, the next day, one by one, people did come. They came, the Aboriginal community came, females together and then males together, They did get their kit off, and they did stand still for the minute and a half it took to take the digital scan.
And then the white fellows came,
and the white fellows came in their families, and it was a really extraordinary thing. Because
aren't people astonishing, really, that they would participate in that?
But I think Philip, I think that's the real, for me, returning art to the centre of human life. As a place of reflection about who we are, where we come from, where we might be going collectively, our relationship to place and the planet as a whole. I think this is a central thing. And it's a very strange thing. You know, we have made art into a specialization in which people feel that they can't participate, or, you know, oh, I can't draw, I don't go to art galleries, I might go to the football pitch, but I want to bring art back as a kind of a place of possibility, a test site for life.
I know that people ridicule the Archibald, but in its simple way, it also attracts a large audience who stand in front of painting, something they don't otherwise do, and they look at an image of another human being, and all sorts of things are going on in their mind. And so it's easy to deride, but it too, I think, fulfills a useful role.
What are we talking about?
The Archibald Portrait Prize in Sydney.
We have the BP Portrait Prize at the National Gallery.
I don't think you'll have that at the moment. BP is in a bit of trouble.
What happened about that oil slick?
It's
by the way,
still the world's largest environmental catastrophe, I understand, as we speak.
Christ!
But I mean, this, It is extraordinary that an entire community shed their inhibitions and participated in something so remarkable. How long will the figures stand there?
I sold the work for £1 to the government of Western Australia. I'm still hoping to finish the work. We scanned altogether over 100 people with the hope of making 100 of these memorials, really, to individuals and the landscape. And that's why I'm going on Thursday. I'm hoping to persuade the ministers and some important individuals who are creative and forward-thinking to help complete the work.
Tell me about this image. Here you are sitting surrounded by a vast Lilliputian army. I understand there's 180,000 figurines.
Yeah, I put that into the Sydney Biennale a couple of Biennales ago in Pier 2-3 on the top floor.
180,000 figurines.
I thought it looked fantastic. Now, this was another attempt to think about, in a way, the collective body, about individuals and masses, about the way that we are, in a way, collectively looking at a common future, which may or may not happen with us. The idea of Field was to make a collaborative work. I made this with 350 assistants in Huadu, in Shanshan village, Huadu, and it was an extraordinary...
So there was variation in those figures?
Oh, total variation. There were only three rules, as it were. They had to be hand-sized, they had to stand up, and they had to have eyes. And then from that point onwards, it was up to every individual to make the work exactly as they saw fit. And what happens is you entirely inhabit a architectural space, in this case quite large. I mean, this was about 6,000 square metres in total, and we used about 4,000 square metres to install the work. You shouldn't be able to see the floor, and you look on this field through a threshold, and as you come up to this threshold, you realise that inadvertently you have become the focus of the art's gaze, and it's as if this field is looking back at you and saying, what are you going to do about us? It's as if they are the unborn or the ancestors.
Both, the past and the future,
identified with the earth. And we are, we are put in the position of being gods who are determining the future.
Did the Xi'an warriors in any sense influence this concept?
No, I actually made the very first version of this I made here in Australia, because it was very much a response to this extraordinary red continent that made me think that Australia in some way has always been the conscience of the planet. In some way you are aware of the earth and the condition of the earth in Australia in a way that I have not found anywhere else in the world. And I made the first
version. So it's that draws you back rather than the scent of mangoes? Because we have very good mangoes.
Yeah, no, mangoes haven't been high on my list. I think it is. I think it's the smell of earth after rain, the extraordinary intensity of the heat in the middle of this continent. The Yilgarn Craton I called the piece with the 51 figures that are hopefully going to be 100. Inside Australia, and that sits in the middle of the Yilgarn Craton, which is a piece of granitic rock that was created, between 3.5 and 2.9 billion years ago. It's one of the biggest and oldest intact bits of the Earth's surface. And I think I go there with a feeling of respect, of a profound understanding of the insignificance of the human species.
But you don't abandon hope because of that.
No, do you? No. I don't
you
want
say
to abandon,
here, right? Every person is one pixel in a bigger picture.
Yes, that's right.
Well, it's not a bad lie.
I think that we're all trying to make sense of the world. We're all trying to make a world for ourselves and share it In other words, make one that is commonly held. I think art is one of the ways in which that realization can maybe become stronger. And it's very important. It's very, very important to me that we use it. I think that, you know, every person has an enormous creative potential. I think so many of us can feel in some way constrained, or that we have no, that we can't actually contribute to possible futures. I think art is one of the ways in which everyone can, Anthony, as a participator.
Anthony, I live in the bush quite a long way from Sydney, and years ago I discovered that everyone I met out there can do something better than I can. Mm. The immense amount of talent that people have, even if they find it hard to read or write, is quite extraordinary.
Well, I think that's what happens when, in a way, people live closer to the elements. And I was just up in the Blue Mountains, and it's clear in this little valley that I was in that everybody helps each other do everything, you know, whether it's, putting in a new water tank or fetching your roof back from the bottom of the valley when it's blown off in a high wind. And I think that's something that, in a sense, we lose in this high-density urban life that now 50% of the world's population lives in. We live very close together, but very far apart.
I'm always nervous about discussing visual art on this program. It's very hard to do on radio. You are quite exceptionally articulate. Little wonder that you got yourself an OBE. I'd give you one if you hadn't got one. A Turner Prize and other awards too numerous to mention. So that Catholic background of yours.
Yeah, maybe they taught me well. I have no idea. I mean, I think that you have to, in a way, unlearn as much as you learn. You know, I'm very, very aware that one of the things that learning out of books teaches you is to read everything. And so that we turn direct experience somehow into, through a kind of hermeneutics, into a symbolic relationship or a meta language or an indirect relationship with the world. And now that most of us spend most of our time looking at monitors, and I spend most of my time looking at this bloody BlackBerry, that's compounded. And somehow, that's why I love sculpture, because it returns you to the primary experience of engaging with what you can touch, with what you can see.
If you ever come up and stay at the farm and you're invited, you will find yourself surrounded by thousands of terracotta figures from all the ancient world. And I find these little figures, invariably made of clay, some carved from wood or cast from metal, but overwhelmingly clay, deeply moving. Mm. And sometimes you can still see the fingerprints of the guy that made the damn thing 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years ago or more.
But isn't that magic?
Isn't that a magic thing?
That you can have a conversation, you know, across time and space with another human being that you may, you know, that you don't communicate with through words, but you can touch and you can feel.
It's almost as magical as communicating with you, Anthony Corbett. This has been absolutely marvellous, and I thank you very much for popping in and illuminating us. The prolific English sculptor in Australia touring his latest work, Firmament. And this is also on a pretty grand scale, and we'll put some references to it on our website. And, Anthony, you do a great job, and I'm astonished that someone has got as far down the track in the highly competitive and often quite unpalatable world of art without a hint of scepticism or cynicism, rather.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Philip. I take your invitation, and I'd love to see both your land and the things that you have surrounded yourself with. Thank you.
On our next, Laura Tingle, there's a wonderful name, Anthony, takes us through the new buy-low budget, and we look at the tricky relationship between Afghanistan and the US. Both sides should start making thousands and thousands and thousands of clay figures and sort things out that way. Time, I think, now for Elena Katz-Chernin to take us out and then to hear the news on Radio National.